My name's Will Davis from the Centre for Interdisciplinary Methodologies, University of Warwick, and I'm here with my colleague Nate Tkach.
Hello.
And we're interviewing Professor Philip Borowski from University of Notre Dame, who's been visiting us for a couple of days, giving a keynote lecture yesterday at our conference, Where Do Neoliberals Go After the Market? And then this afternoon, a seminar on his ongoing work on the history of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Philip has a new book out, Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste, which is published by Verso in a couple of weeks. And this is building on other recent work on the history of neoliberalism as contained in his book with Dieter Plevy, The Road from Mont Pelerin. So Philip, perhaps we could start by you saying a little bit about the genesis of this recent work in terms of how did you come to write the new book on the crisis, and how did it relate to your long-standing interest in the history of economics and the neoliberal thought collective more generally?
Right. Well, the Mont Pelerin book was the result of a collaboration between myself and actually a number of people, all of whom were at a conference at NYU in 2005. And before that time, I had been working a little bit on the history of the Chicago School, but what was really interesting was in encountering these people, many of whom were Europeans, who actually knew a lot more about Mont Pelerin society than I did at that point. It had made me see that this was a much larger story, and also that because the Mont Pelerin Society itself was not the brainchild of a single person, but was in fact the result of a large number of people from many different cultural contexts, that this kind of collaborative work of people from at least from Europe and America, although some of the papers were in Chile too, and Tim Mitchell, for example, as well, that was a good way to begin to try to understand this multifaceted nature of the Mont Pelerin Society. So there's that. And I and a student, former student now, Rob Van Horn, did the paper on the Chicago School in there. And also, in order to try to tie it together, I had an ending, a postscript of the book, which was called Defining Neoliberalism. And the problem there that we encountered, and I think I still encounter, is that many people on the left use the term neoliberalism kind of as a swear word or a sneer word or something, and are not very... they're not very precise, and maybe not even all that interested as to what that refers to and how to differentiate that from other groups on the right, so on, to the point that I've heard, and probably you too, that all kinds of people, including people on the left, saying that it doesn't really exist, that it's all kind of in your mind, it's made up, and so forth. So the thing I did at the end was to argue that even though it is not the result of a single mind, and it changes over time, since the genesis of the Mont Pelerin Society in 1947, that it does converge on certain kind of general doctrines that one could specify, even though, taking into account that it doesn't cover everyone and there's always arguments internally, so forth and so on. So I did that. And that seemed to help a lot of people clarify things to a certain extent about what neoliberalism refers to. But I wasn't happy with that volume in a couple ways. One way was that it was very much intellectual history. And something that's odd about the neoliberals is that not only is much of neoliberalism about epistemology, but it also creates a new kind of role, which you and I have talked about, which is this the development, not originally in the 40s, but it took a while, the development of the anti-intellectual intellectual. And we can talk about what that means, but the thing that's important about that here is it's very hard to approach this phenomenon as an intellectual historian in standard ways, reading texts, interpreting them, and so forth, when in fact this is a strange group of people who are very sophisticated, I think, philosophically, but at the same time don't operate in the standard modalities of the intellectual and know that in some sense. So it's a little worrisome to write an intellectual history of something that denies itself, right? So originally my plan, actually I had a bunch of other irons in the fire too, and one of them was the book Science Mart that came out, that I was doing a lot of work on the history of science and the commercialization of science at the same time. I was thinking roughly of trying to deal with neoliberalism more on a kind of a human scale, to try to get at this problem of the anti-intellectual intellectual. So at first, when I pitched the book to Verso, it was going to be called Everyday Neoliberalism, and it was going to be about how people who could not be bothered about politics and, you know, wouldn't care about neoliberalism and so forth, in their everyday lives are come to see themselves through these kind of neoliberal lenses to the point where it really changes the way that they live their life. So that was the idea. And then the crisis hit. Okay. And then when the crisis hit, I mean, the other part of the historian of economics and me kicked in and said, this is clearly the most important thing that's going to happen in my lifetime with regard to economics, and how could you not pay attention, and how could, so at first they weren't the same project. I mean, I just started collecting stuff. I have so many I have binders by year at home of you know, what happened and who said what to whom and things like that. So I was just doing that, and then I think the narrative line kind of popped out at me for the book, which is that at the beginning of the crisis, all kinds of people were saying this would be the death of neoliberalism. See, so it was convenient. I was working on neoliberalism, then the crisis hits, and then people, all kinds of people, Joseph Stiglitz, I mean, we go down, there's a zillion people in the left, and then it was pretty clear that all that was way premature, and not very well thought out, and I sort of start the book by talking about me being at INET, Institute for New Economic Thought, in, God, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, whenever it was in New Hampshire, beginning to see that not only would the neoliberals not be undermined or undone, that in fact they were winning, and they were winning at this organization which nominally gave a self-account that it was going to develop new economic thought where there was very little to be seen. And so that really impressed, and that became the real narrative plot line then, right? I mean, it's that, you know, not only do I try to understand neoliberalism on the day-to-day level, there's still a chapter called Everyday Neoliberalism in it, but now I need to explain how the crisis could come along. And that they, not that they, from square one, knew what to do, because I don't think that's right. I want to be careful about that, too. But that they really quickly developed a whole set of techniques such that they really outmaneuvered the left amazingly. I mean, embarrassingly, I think, from the point of view of the left. Mm-hmm. To the point where they now have essentially defined what happened. When we look back now, I mean, basically most of what we have is not only neoliberal policies, which everybody knows about, but we have neoliberal stories too. So that's truly an amazing phenomenon. People in the future are going to want to know why that happened. So I want a first crack at that. So
yeah.
So there it is.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned quite a few times in your lecture yesterday, and again just now, that the left have been outmaneuvered, and that the left often don't even really understand what neoliberalism is,
yeah.
Partly because they're too blinkered by their own kind of sort of pejorative use of the term neoliberal or
sometimes,
something like that.
Yeah.
But what do you think might be gained politically from this more accurate depiction that you're trying to present? And are there any sources of hope in any of this in terms of alternatives?
Yeah.
And what might those alternatives learn from the work that you're doing?
Obviously, I mean, I know that that's what I provoke when I start giving talks on the book, is that somebody invariably asks, you know, what's the reaction or what should be the reaction? And I think one initial thing that we should take from it is that the whole neoliberal project is never the brainchild of a single person. It has not been. I know that, you know, many people kind of try to read neoliberalism off Hayekian cyclicals or something like that. But, you know, being immersed in it for so long, I realize that it's actually an amazingly efficiently distributed thought collective. And so, I mean, to begin with, for somebody to ask me what the answer is then shows really how naive the left has become. That, you know, if it took that kind of intellectual and social organization over, you know, more than a half a century to get to the point where they could pull off what they did, you know, it's not going to be like one person with the, you know, the answer coming down from the mount to give it to people. I mean, see, I mean, there's a, I think there's a bad holdover from Marxism where, you know, you read the text of the famous guy usually and, you know, interpret the politics from there. So, I mean, that's just the beginning. I know that's not very much of an answer, but I mean, that's the beginning. And then I think a second answer is, how much should we learn from them? And it's weird, I keep wanting to provoke this argument, but I don't know, want to have it yet. That, you know, should there be a counter Mont Pelerin? Mm. Is that too hierarchical? Is that too conspiratorial? Could the left stand what that says about politics and its past relationship with Leninism and so forth? You see, so I mean, I think these are the kind of questions that are like totally avoided on the left these days. And this kind of work forces it. I mean, it really does. It sort of makes you think, well, look, yeah, either I can decide that his whole story is way too conspiratorial and this is just a small phenomenon, or I can take this seriously and think, what would a left response look like to it? So.
One of the things that Nate and I have been talking about here at Warwick is how theories of neoliberalism and some of the kind of epistemological dimensions of neoliberalism that you've stressed a lot in your work relate to a parallel set of debates that are going on in relation to software studies, theories of computation, questions about data, and so on. And we were very excited to have you visiting us, and that was partly what inspired the conference yesterday, which was an effort to try and have this debate about technologies, software, at the same time as markets and economics. As I know you've written about some of that kind of interface in previous works, machine dreams and so on.
Right.
And so that was one of the things we tried to do with the conference yesterday. So I mean, perhaps Nate, you could pick up from here in terms of some of the kind of specific research themes this kind of interrelationship between economics and digital.
Yeah, there are several ways in. I mean, maybe we can begin with the beginning of the event, and in a sense, it was a little bit playful what I was trying to do by positioning these kind of big data analyst claims next to these kind of Hayekian kind of comments from a long time ago, knowing full well that you can't capture, of course, the full spectrum, but to what extent, because you, of course, this kind of Californian style or from MIT is kind of prone to these gross exaggerations and so on, but to just how do we attend to this kind of person, what kind of tradition maybe do they belong to, and how, if at all, do they connect with, given that they're making specific claims that do start to enter into this territory about knowing the market in a sense, which is very different from a kind of a neoliberal.
Just to be clear, you're talking about sort of data scientists and quants and these sorts of people who have kind of mathematical and physics-based skills.
What was the name of that guy who was claiming that he knew better than Adam Smith and Karl Marx?
I was pointing to this article in The Edge by the big data scientist from MIT called Sandy Pentland, who has a new a connection science center that he set up there. So I'd be very interested as a starting point.
Well, you're right that Machine Dreams did talk about this a little bit, but not that. There was conceived among some of these early cybernetics guys, and by this I mean sort of 50s, 60s, that their vision of perhaps the mind, perhaps artificial intelligence and so forth, was very similar to some of the things that Hayek was saying about the mind in Century Order, but also that Hayek was saying about the market. So I think early on they recognized certain affinities, and by the way, Hayek did too. I mean, there's some evidence that he thought he saw that as well, okay? But then, there's another thing that's going on, which is, I think, the progressive cultural phenomenon of neoliberalism, the way in which people see themselves in their everyday life in largely through neoliberal lens. So a lot of these things are converging. You see, I don't think it's just one intellectual connection at all. I think there are probably quite a few. And in the new book, in the chapter on kind of everyday neoliberalism, I try to talk a little bit about how one very important on-the-ground characteristic of neoliberalism is everyone, and this is well known from Foucault, that everyone is supposed to be an entrepreneur of themselves, mm-hmm. right? And so, but what that ultimately means is that it really is a kind of a rejection of the whole Enlightenment tradition of the self, because there is no core to the self anymore, and you know, you're supposed to kind of just adjust to whatever other units, I don't know if you call them people, want you to be, and so forth. And then the way in which Facebook is very much a kind of an almost an online training mechanism for this kind of vision of the world. So I think there are many aspects of the development of especially social media and online games and things like that that very much exist to kind of help you imagine yourself this way. So, I don't want to go into Facebook in a lot of detail, but I mean, the fact that you have to, you know, to really get lots of people to like you and everything, you have to like update this stuff all the time. So, I mean, it's teaching you to do the kinds of things that they imagined the entrepreneurial self would be like. See, I mean, I'm sort of crabby and not on Facebook. See, so I don't do that. I don't think of myself that way. You see, so I mean, there's really there are a number of much more specific ways in which we can think culturally about how neoliberalism doesn't win simply because they take over the state. Although, geez, that helps. But you know, it wins because it is really a convincing story of, you know, who I am and what we can hope for and so forth and so on. I try to stress this yesterday, that it's a very upbeat story. I don't think people appreciate that enough, that it really has, they didn't start out that way at all, but they managed to, you know, get to this point where, you know, their ultimate solutions to things really are science fiction, gee whiz bang things. And see, so they really have to buy into these techno-scientific imaginaries to make this whole story about the market finding the way out to work. So that's really important. See, so there's a heavy cultural element in this too. I didn't stress that so much, but I would stress that, and I try to, to a certain extent.
Yeah. Thanks. I want to use this to get to this reemergence of ideas of openness, which is bound up with these data discussions, but it's also more generalized.
Mm.
And something that I've tried to think about quite a lot is the extent to which this new kind of openness that crosses through things like open data and open government, but it's also used to describe projects that I've written about, such as Wikipedia, and you have also written about, and perhaps we can get there in a moment. But I'm really interested to hear your take. This is one thing that I've tried to think about, but not having the kind of the resources of the economic historian. It's the position of Popper within the Monpowerian society and possibly by extension, if you could say something about the relation between openness or the open and the market, which to me seems to be really interesting and very challenging. And sometimes it seems like there's a hierarchical relationship, like maybe openness is this kind of very vague and broad condition that then markets emerge in, or sometimes openness is a response to a failed market, it needs to be more open, or there are all of these kind of entanglements that I think are interesting. But if it's
that's an incredibly tangled and convoluted
question. But I mean, that's not saying about you, but I mean, there's so many ways you could go with it with these guys. Let me do a simple way and then a more complicated way. A simple way is, there was actually a very specific conflict between Popper and Hayek in the early Montpellier society. And we know this because there's this interesting correspondence. And what it is, you know, Popper was going on and on about his open society theories with Hayek, but with regard to the Montpellier society, you know, that why shouldn't that be open, and why, you know, shouldn't we have some you know, reasonable socialists come talk to us and so forth and so on, because that's the way we're going to find truth. And I'm going to come back to this whole issue of where the truth comes from in a minute. But and Hayek is intransigent with this. And by the way, ultimately, I think this is why Popper kind of just tails off and drops out. Hayek says, well, you know, there's a real problem is that, you know, we don't want to have these interminable arguments with people who don't agree on basic principles. And so I understand what you're saying, and of course freedom is everything, but really it is a
the musical.
Do you see why this is so important? Yeah. But for the purposes of figuring out our politics, we need a closed society. See? So this is your, see how this is a simple answer to your thing, is that, you know, one reading of the Popper openness is rejected, I think, early on, and persistently so throughout. But they also, of course, there's attention for them because they're going on and on about freedom and liberty all the time. So, you know, part of the issue is, what is this openness? And I think this is why understanding the neoliberals as an epistemic project is so important for how they seemingly square that circle. So it's there, they know it's there, what do they do? What they do is their idea of openness is kind of in general, you know, for the populace, for the vast majority of everybody. Openness means anyone can claim or assert any damn thing they please, okay? I mean, and, you know, as long as someone will pay them to say it, fine, it becomes part of the marketplace of ideas. And so it's not, remember, this is one level, it's not our role to decide what's good, bad, or scream, that the market will do it for us. See, so weirdly enough, this is what you're suggesting, that openness comes to mean subordination to the market as a kind of a solution. Now, of course, this leads to another contradiction. Well, why isn't that true for the Mont Pelerin Society too? You say, like, why isn't what's sauce for the goose should be sauce for the gander? But in fact, they don't believe that at all. They believe that there has to be a kind of a core of political activism that has to impose a market world that will not happen by itself, you see. And so for that to happen, I mean, that isn't a matter of, you know, letting everyone just say what they want. I mean, you got to have a closed quasi-Leninist unit that's going to do this kind of work. And so that's what you get. You get both. For the masses, I think, what you get is openness means the market, you know, and with truth being the outcome. But then for creation of the world that they think needs to happen, they need much more concerted, hierarchical, and to a certain extent, you know, Leninist strategies to take over a strong state and make a lot of this happen. See, so I mean, so, a good trick about this is that they can have it both ways, you know. And I'm not saying that it's only them that do this. Somebody was giving me a hard time last night at dinner about this, that, you know, are they wrong because they have a contradictory thing? No, a lot of politics is like that. But see, I think what's interesting is that they have come to their own accommodation through these means to that, whereas the left doesn't even want to think about it. Those same kind of contradictory,
yeah,
tendencies, principles, so forth and so on. So that's why, back to your original question, that's why so much of this kind of innovation and interaction online and so forth really has a neoliberal tinge to it, because it really can easily follow that openness script, right? I mean, supposed transparency, everyone can have their say, everyone can participate, but in fact, you know, all that really means is that everyone has to submit to the market to decide what the truth is about what they say, about their life, so on.
And I mean, in a sense, what you said about this kind of two different rules or two different approaches, where you have a kind of a general idea of openness, but then you actually do things very differently.
Yes.
I mean, this is very much how, at the end of the Mont Pelerin book, you have this large section on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And I arrived at that after I had finished a PhD thesis about Wikipedia on the idea of openness, and it's a very critical piece. And then to read you describing this logic that I had been trying to deal with was, I was like, wow, this is an economist who is now describing Wikipedia as a kind of a neoliberal thing. And for me, I traced it through the open source movement and the idea of open source development, the cathedral and the bazaar. Eric Raymond, of course.
Raymond,
So who's a libertarian, but nonetheless, the bazaar is a market.
Mm.
And so I've been trying to grapple with to what extent these trajectories had moved into so-called Web 2.0 and come to kind of map over, and then to what extent they were now kind of rolling back into governmental form, like institutional governmental forms, as something new, but kind of what's going on in that space. So I was very thrilled even when I kind of came to this passage.
I think if I could just say something, what's important about that is even these people who are very interested in new technologies and so forth, I mean, truth be told, they cannot be bothered about politics, at least for political theory and so forth. So it's very important for us to understand the way they could not care a whit about political theory, and yet basically have much of the story imparted to them merely through their interaction with, through the technologies, talking to each other about these ideals and so forth and so on. I mean, see, they don't need to be formally inculcated or anything like that. And that's what's fascinating to me, that it wasn't like that in the 1950s and 60s. This has developed so far. It's gotten to that point now where you can almost take it in just in daily life. And the role of the technologies are very important. And it's no surprise that some of the big name advocates of these technologies are also openly either libertarian or neoliberal. See, because I mean, the technologies help express what a life lived that way is like. Okay.
Yes, I've got two very, I mean, this is very interesting for me, but I think there's something about the question on whether or not you can describe something like a neoliberal technology, whether or not something like Wikipedia as a software platform actually is inscribed with certain mechanisms. And I know that you've commented on this kind of well-known link between Jimmy Wales and he's a kind of a Hayek enthusiast, but I also think the specific history of Wikipedia doesn't really provide that narrative, but it very much lends itself to someone like Wales reflecting and kind of understanding retrospectively that this is what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to take it kind of away from Wikipedia, because one of the things, my background is in media theory, and there is this question about the kind of inscription technologies that is also very strong in STS.
Mm-hmm.
And there are moments where it seems like paying attention to technical devices is very important, but I also found myself when I was reading some of the literature in social studies of finance, which has become very, very detailed and very, very focused on specific instruments, and kind of pitched in terms of description as a form of political project, and I find a lot of that material kind of less than satisfactory, but at the same time, I don't want to kind of give up this question of sometimes you really need to focus on these details, but then other times, where does the description end? When does it have to be connected to something else? And if you could speak to that.
Sure. Maybe I can even make it a little more concrete, because one of the examples in the book is global warming, right? And one very nice example in social studies is kind of social studies of finance is the work that's been done on things like trading carbon permits mechanism. So there's great detailed work about how that happens. There's even a very nice article on how it got perverted through hydrofluorocarbons permits, which were coming out of China, and they were making tons of money on it. It really didn't, it wasn't to the point of the whole permit system. So fine, so that's good stuff. All of it's good stuff. But the problem is, that social studies as science never wants to talk politics, or they say everything is political, but they don't want to become embroiled in, you know, the large archive of discussions of political theory and so forth. So they want to believe that they can live without that. And that's really their flaw, is that ultimately they don't have any really clear ideas of, you know, do they all kind of think we're all liberals together, and are we all classical liberals or whatever? See, I mean, they just cannot be bothered. And bring it back to the original example, they almost by default kind of buy into the carbon permit trading as, well, of course, it is probably the practical thing we can do about global warming. Whereas all you have to do is pull back a little, know something about, you know, the politics literature of about that, and what you discover is that permits don't reduce carbon emissions at all, and most permit schemes, at least for carbon, have crashed. I mean, you know, they don't even work. So there's that. And then you sit back and you think, well, wait a minute, are people just stupid, or do some people know that this is true? See, this is where you really get into politics then. 4S doesn't want to go there, because if some people know that this is true, then that opens up the possibility that this is just an instrumental means to an end, and the larger end is not being talked about at all. And that actually is a case that I make in the book, that carbon trading is just another neoliberal project to buy time by inventing new markets to supposedly take care of problems that are happening in other older markets. And generally what happens is that they don't take care of the problems, they just multiply all kinds of, you know, market instruments to divert people from other kinds of interventions, which might, I'm not saying will, but might actually abate carbon emissions, do you see? As far as I know, 4S doesn't want to go there, all right? And that's a real problem. I mean, for a group that think of themselves as kind of political and, you know, showing that science is political, I mean, they are amazingly unwilling.
I think there's a real, I mean, there's, for me, there's quite a rich political ontology in some of the STS toolkit, but there's no moment of strategy in that way of thinking about politics. So the actual terms of description are kind of filled with these kind of with political,
well, politically charged words.
There are allies and so all of these things, loading and and so the language is highly politicized, but then there's no strategy, right. and it seems to me that's, I mean, you're very different. The very question of posing thought collective seems to be impossible from that space.
I mean, you could contrast my work to Bruno Latour, and we won't go into this in too much detail, but I mean, Latour sees himself now as applying social studies as science to politics, when, in fact, in my humble opinion, what's happening is that he is simply showing all the ways in which they cannot address politics in social studies of science. Now, you know, I don't want to, there's no point going into great detail on that, but I think people who have read that literature have some sense of that there's something very strange going on there with all, some of the leading members of this crowd claiming that they could do some kind of political theory without really taking into account the real politics of real controversies in the current era, which are scientific as well. See, that's the odd thing, that many of them are scientific, and yet they cannot really take positions in a serious way.
Can I just press you on some things, partly going back to something Nate was saying earlier in relation to data and open data? It seems to me that one of the things you've claimed is that under neoliberalism, or for neoliberals, the market is the ultimate arbiter of truth. There's an epistemological claim about the market, not a kind of efficiency argument as such.
Exactly. I think that's what's very interesting about them, is that they get confused with neoclassical economics. And one of my, you know, quests in life is to stop everyone else from doing that. That neoclassical economics has one set of stories. I'm not thrilled with them, but I mean, you know, at least you have to know what they are. And most, but not all, of the neoliberals are opposed to that set of stories and have developed wildly different stories. And the most important thing is that they've changed the ontology of the market, which I think is an amazing move, isn't it? You know, what is a market? For a neoclassical, it's just an allocation of scarce resources between given, you know, given possible uses, okay? And it's really kind of mechanics. Whereas for the neoliberals, it's all about the mind and epistemology. Let me be careful, not about the mind.
So my question is then, where does this leave what seems to me a recent explosion in kind of neo-positivism that we're seeing around us a lot at the moment? Things like neuroscience, the kind of big data revolution, is, it might be market-like in its sort of language or its ethos, but there seems to be some sense that with things like fMRI technologies, big data analytics, new kind of Benthamite interest in kind of, you know, hedonic experience and so on, all of that stuff's going on. Smart cities where, you know, policymakers are going to be able to have so much data about the city that they'll be able to run experiments and change behavior. I mean, obviously markets are kind of part of that story, and the markets might benefit from that story in things like neuroscience and so on. But there seems to me a parallel epistemological thing going on at the moment, which is more positivist than the depiction of neoliberals that you made.
No, I think you're right about that. That a tense issue with the neoliberals is, of course, their relationship to science. Right. See that, and I have written about that fairly extensively. That from Hayek onwards. You know, they not only do they distrust intellectuals generally, but they really distrust the natural scientist. And so, this is a problem that neoliberalism actually doesn't. I mean, it's not that there aren't neoliberal scientists; there can be, but in general, their response to any particular intellectual problem is not immediately to try to turn it into some kind of old-fashioned empiricist scientific question. So what, and that's why it's so important that the neoclassicals still exist, because the neoclassicals really are still the slavish imitators of whatever is cool in the natural scientists. So obvious in its history. And so all the neuro stuff that you're talking about, I mean, that is, to me, is just another chapter in the long annals of neoclassical economics looking for some kind of justification in some natural science. Okay, basically. So that is not something that neoliberals would generally do. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's that. So there's one tension there. But it does strike me that when you see neoliberal science, what it is instead is bold entrepreneurial interventions in the world that will create new market-like things. And see, that's not the stuff that you're doing. I mean, there are all kinds of people who, I run into this all the time still. I mean, what's the standard reaction to kind of, you know, a young undergraduate when they finally are exposed to microeconomics? It's that people don't think like that. I mean, it's just so it's been happening for more than 100 years now, okay? Well, see, a lot of the stuff that you're talking about is the neoclassicals claiming, oh yeah, we know what your objections are, and you know, we now understand how we can adjust our theory so that it's more like the way that people think and behave. You see, with of course using natural science, because they have never made any close pact with psychology. I mean, see, that's interesting, and it's never really been, I think, fully written out in the history of economics, that neoclassicals avoid psychology like the plague, but every once in a while get excited about any time a natural scientist claims that they have a reductionist theory of the brain. It's that, ooh, good, that's what we want too. And so it was true back with Edgeworth and their fascination with psychophysics and all that. Now we've got this neuroeconomics. You see, I mean, it's a real, I think, continual pattern. So there's a couple things going on. And again, I want to reiterate for whatever audience that the reason the two can be often conflated or confused, because there is one crossover group known as the Chicago School, which just happens to be the school that everybody knows about, that tries to meld the two and make the two work together to make neoclassical microtheory work with pure neoliberal politics. Okay, so it is true that there is a version of this. But I think what people need to understand is that that's actually kind of a small version, or I don't know, maybe a minority version of these bigger movements, both the neoclassical movement and the neoliberal movement.
Yeah.
something that seems, and I'm just throwing ideas around, but something that seems very interesting and maybe poses or at least has some resonances with the neoliberal epistemology within something like big data science, and this is something that you've been looking into as well, Will, so maybe you can say something to it also, is that it operates at the level of correlation rather than causality, which you can read as a kind of anti-intellectual impulse, because explanation is removed, and then the data that gets gathered, that gets fed into this science, and this is what I was trying to talk about yesterday, is understood first and foremost as ontological. So it just is, it exists. It's not a form of knowledge. And then we just put that together and look at these correlations, and then that produces something. And it seems to me, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm kind of really getting at it, but this, there's this kind of, where's the epistemology in this mode? And
well, I think there are two versions, or two possible versions. I mean, one is just that it's true that there are no explanatory commitments, because we defer to the market in the fullness of time to give us, you know, to extract noise, I'm sorry, signal from noise, okay? So that could be one version. But then I think there's this more kind of scientist neoclassical version, which is, you know, still a kind of a positivist, let's just look for constant conjunctions of correlation or something. There has been a subset of the economics profession that's been doing that since really World War II, called econometrics and so forth. So you see, so I mean, there could be, but that, the second one really does think someday it's going to find cause, or it wants to reduce it to theory. Okay. Whereas the first one actually doesn't care, and I think that's what you're pointing to, that there's a version of this that actually does not care, and that somehow, as long as there are all kinds of ways to sell forms of surveillance and forms of repackaging, everything will work out, because, you know, it's not us, it's not me, I don't decide it, you don't decide it. See, so some kind of group mind, but really the market is going to decide it instead.
One might argue that, in addition to the Chicago School being that conflation of positivism and neoliberalism.
Yes, I know, which is so odd, really.
But another one you could say is that contemporary financial markets are also a point of nexus for those two traditions, because you have these quants and these economic model builders,
right.
These rationalists working in an environment that is dictated by a kind of Hayekian epistemology of deep uncertainty and supposed kind of organic, spontaneous, emergent order in some sense.
Yeah,
so you've got
a kind of
conflation of the kind of mathematical positivist mindset and the Hayekian skeptical mindset in a single place of Wall Street.
Well,
and in a sense, that's what possibly the social studies of finance is quite good at getting towards, is recognizing that markets as a neoliberal principle and economics as a kind of positivist mechanism kind of come together and create this.
No, that's a very interesting insight. Mm-hmm. Although Martha Poon was saying to me yesterday that if you actually pay attention to how these things are structured, there's actually two groups within that financial sphere. There are these sort of quants, and then there are the people who are really much more traders.
Right.
And it's the quants who are come from physics backgrounds that are closer to the sort of, you know, neoclassical, or the belief in black scholes and all the rest of it. And it's the traders who, well, of course, they have to know something about this. They actually are the true Hayekians. And, you know, just think that the quants are useful to tell you what everyone else is thinking.
Right.
See, it's the other guy who is the... Isn't that an interesting idea? It's the other guy who's this rationalist, but who doesn't truly understand how markets work, and that's why you can make money.
Yeah. So, well, thank you very much, Philip, for a fascinating discussion. I think we're going to wrap things up now.
Okay.
So thank you very much for visiting us.
Thank you.
Thanks.